This episode, I'm joined by Patrick McNamara, who is an American neuroscientist whose work centers on three major topics: sleep and dreams, religion, and mind/brain. In this episode, we discuss his book, Religion, Neuroscience, and the Self, A New Personalism, alongside discussions on anarchism, the anarch, Christianity, and more. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you've enjoyed anything that I've produced in the last year and would like to support the podcast, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, please enjoy. So, Patrick McNamara, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So we are going to be discussing your soon-to-be-published book, Religion, Neuroscience and the Self, A New Personalism. And this is a book that sort of is revolving around the idea of personalism. And in that sense, you know, I guess one of the major questions is, well, how do we define a person? Which, you know, throughout history has been a tough question. And I don't want to play the card of things are different in our time, as everyone would play. But there's a lot of things technologically, religiously, spiritually, which are happening in this time of acceleration and division, which ultimately the symptoms of which are going to question what a person is. But before we jump in with all these major questions, just tell us a little bit about yourself, what it is you do, and how this book came about.
Yeah, thanks, James. Well, you said it's soon to be published book, but it has been published. It's published by Routledge.
I apologize.
No worries. I think it was a couple of years ago came out. I was raised in a Catholic household and always have been interested in religion. And when you're raised Catholic household, one of the trends or themes that gets repeated, you know, over the years is this emphasis on the dignity of the person and all that kind of stuff. And there's sort of a background philosophy, and many Catholic saints, popes, et cetera, have leaned on. That's generally referred to as personalism. So I started to get very interested in that. So from a very early age, I was very sort of individualistic, I hated being parts of groups, that kind of thing. And went through this period of anarchism, really steeped myself in anarchist philosophy, then became a scientist, neuroscientist. You know, that's what I got my degree in, so behavioral neuroscience. And had these longstanding passions, but you know, passionate interest in religion, passionate interest in science. And I found I could combine those by taking neuroscience approaches to religious experience, religious cognition. And I've been doing that for years, publishing in that realm for years, but then got quite concerned recently, in the last 10 years or so. I feel that I've begun to notice very worrying trends, political, social, cultural trends. You know, like it seems like a general cultural decline, I think, and sort of the rise of the surveillance super states all around the globe. And I think there's a real issue of the rise of super intelligent machines, and this has profound consequences, in my opinion, for our understanding of the person and personalism. And that's why I decided to write this book. It's, you know, sort of outside of my usual work. You know, I usually sort of stay in scientific realm, and this has a good deal of philosophy and theology in it. Mm-hmm. So that's how I came to write this book, because I got quite concerned about political and cultural trends in the modern age, you know, the last 10 years in particular.
So the anarchism never really left?
No.
Who did you, when you were into anarchism, did you lean on any? I mean, obviously, to say you're of a specific anarchic school is a bit contrary to the question of anarchism, but was there, were there thinkers you had more sympathies to?
Many of the American anarcho-individualists, but, you know, some of the famous names like Bakunin. Bakunin really impressed me because he kept saying, like, how come we always say to God, you know, you're so great and wonderful and magnificent, and we're so horrible, degraded, and, you know, like, why do we... You know, Nietzsche asked this question as well, like, why do we put all value into the supernatural realm and degrade ourselves? And, you know, my understanding of Christian message and Jesus in particular is he said, I call you friends now, not servants. So, you know, that's what it, that to me is one really important strand in personalism is, you know, the dignity of the human vocation. You know, we're not just servants, we're co-creators in a fundamental sense. So we need to take that seriously anyway. And the, to me, the anarchists took that seriously.
Okay. Okay. Well, I guess with all those interests as this, by, you know, your personal foundation. I know you're excited to answer this question. Before we kick anything off, I have to ask you the Hermetics question. You can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
Yeah, they were the ones I decided to pick were indeed Christian anarchists. At least they called themselves that. I think they did. Nikolai Berdyaev, Simon Weil, and Edgar Breitman. Edgar Breitman, you probably haven't heard of him. He was a Boston personalist. He was a philosopher of religion at Boston University. He died in 1953. But I think he was the best of the Boston personalists. He was Methodist, I think. But he wrote some fantastic books. And in particular, he had this conception of a finite, infinite God. So God was infinite spirit, but voluntarily relinquished omnipotence so that he could be in solidarity with human beings. And I think Simone Weil had a very similar conception of God, and certainly Berdyaev did. And so all three were like... very intense, almost aristocratic individualists, but at the same time, we're intensely socially engaged, you know. And all three had this amazing conception of who God is, and all three concentrated on the fundamental meaning of freedom, human freedom. And given that fact of human freedom, what does that imply about our relationship to God? And so I'd be very interested to hear that kind, that conversation, you know, along those things like, who is God, and what does it mean to be free?
Do you think there can be a discussion about personalism really without some sort of abstract notion of anarchism in the background? Or individualism, sure. I guess, you know.
Sure, but not in, yeah, there'd have to be some discussion about individualism. What does it mean to be an individual? You know, to have real ontological weight as an individual. You know, this does not deny that we're members of groups. And it does not deny communal responsibilities and the fact that the individual is shaped, constrained, enriched by the social surround, the culture. But we are individuals. You know? We don't want to forget that fact, too. And the anarchists never forgot it, and these three figures emphasize it.
Yeah, and I mean, especially drawing in the religious element, especially the Christian element, I mean, for many figures, the, you know, Christianity, after everything that has come to pass and... you know, the passion has passed by and revelation has happened and we're left now. What really remains in terms of graspable, practical elements is free will, and it's free will of the individual. You know, everything we're sort of doing and acting in the moral good in terms of truth comes back to, well, what are you as an individual going to do in relation to your new understanding as a new man? I try not to lean too hard on the idea that everything comes back to the individual, but I can't really avoid that that conclusion, really.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. But
I think any honest person can avoid that conclusion. No, it's at some point you have to say, what am I responsible for? What am I capable of? You know, you have to accept this sense of agency that we're each given.
Mm-hmm.
We're given some elbow room in the world, you know, and we're given some amount of choice. And so to me, that implies a sense of, you have to take responsibility for yourself. You have to do some self-determination. You know, Sartre really understood this. Sartre was no Christian, obviously, but but he understood it, you know, to the nth degree. So I'm fascinated by figures who really took the idea of self-determination and freedom really seriously and tried to run with the implications of that, particularly the theological implications of it.
Mm. I don't think you can really be a true Christian unless you, well,
the Calvinists disagree.
I guess they would, but you still have a choice in Calvinism, though, because you still have a choice to go to the Calvinist church.
Yeah.
You start getting into the murky waters of predestination, double predestination. It's not a place to.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe we'll theorize quadruple destination, see where we end up. But what would you say then is because, you know, this self-determination, this self, this individual, this individualism, what would you say the difference between a person in relation to personalism and an individual is, if there is such a thing? Because with personalism, it seems we're dealing more with the defining characteristics of something. There isn't as much of that ontological weight that you're on about with the person. It's more abstract.
Yeah, the universe seems to want to, at least the way we know it, we experience things as individuals. There are individual objects all around us. Persons are like individuals in that we're singular. We're a unity, you know. Persons are a unity. We experience ourselves as one entity. But persons are much more than just individual objects, obviously. You know, Boethius said persons are individuals of a rational substance, you know. But we possess ourselves, we own ourselves. I mean, there's a deep theological mystery as to what a person really is. And I try to make that argument in the book that one of the very interesting, unusual things about Christianity is that it's a lot of it is centered around this mystery of the person, because the revelation of Christianity is a person, Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a singular individual, flesh and blood individual. So there's something about personhood that is revelatory of ultimate reality. And people have been trying to plumb that mystery for centuries. You know, many of the church councils were about that very issue. I think what we can say, what I've come to anyway, I mean, fundamental to personal mystery is subjectivity.
Mm.
A lot of what the modern era has accomplished, that's good in my opinion, is consolidation around what we mean by a person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an individual with legal rights and responsibilities, but also this subjectivity.
Mm-hmm.
This sense of self-awareness, self-determination, and self-ownership. And as Kant said, it's a person is an end in himself or herself. You can't be used, and a person cannot be used instrumentally for other ends without violating some ethical code.
Now, you mentioned end there, which is very pertinent for your book, because the personalism that you put forward is eschatological personalism, to do with eschatology, the end times. Now, there's a couple of things I'd throw in here. One is, how would you define this form of personalism, and why do we need this eschatology prior to the personalism? And two, you mentioned, as Kant said, no human being is an end in itself. And it seems actually in the modern world, okay, we've made a lot of leaps in terms of understanding subjectivity. But through that, I mean, especially in the way of, the Western manner of meaning, is actually most individuals just end up means, you know, a means to buy more, a means to go on more holidays, a means to have more pleasure. You know, that we're a means-based value economy, and we've lost most ends, unless you're still practicing some sort of religion. There's the dense matter. I'll hand over you.
Yeah. Well, what I mean by eschatological personalism is that another thing that persons are is that persons are, like Ricoeur argued, producers of meaning. That's where we get meaning from. We get, you know, ultimately the sources of meanings are from persons. And you cannot understand the meaning of an individual, of that individual's life, until they reach the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, Heidegger said the end was in death, you know, and obviously common sense tells us it is. But from the Christian point of view, the end doesn't come until the eschaton arrives, until, you know, the end of time itself. So the ultimate meaning of any individual person is anchored and rooted in that timeless realm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which just adds more weight to the infinite value of a person. So that's what I mean by an eschatological personalism. You can't really grasp the final significance of an individual person until we've seen the end of that person. And from the Christian point of view, that's not till the eschaton, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know the question I'm going to ask, and I think it's maybe... I think it highlights the importance of your, because I'm in complete agreement. The end defines the means, especially with human life. And ultimately, we're talking about, well, what do you do with death? And with this eschatological personalism, well, with a Christian one, yeah, you're the way you comport yourself and the way you act and in relation to good, truth, these all have meaning and value in relation to the end. As you said, the afterlife, the judgment, and so do all religions. And we are now in the anomalous time of so many people either don't care about the end, or they outright admit there's nothing at the end. In which case, well, if your end is nothing, what does that turn the means into? So, well, I would hand that question over to you. What happens to this eschatological personalism when you know, as Heidegger said, you're always pushing death is always pushing you from behind, and you're always pushing past mm-hmm. in front of you. What happens when nothing to go towards, nothing is pushing you? What happens?
Well, I think that's the one major source of cultural decline we see all around us. To me, unless you're anchored in the, you know, from a Christian point of view, unless your heart is anchored in the eternal things, it's much easier for you to get pulled into herd mentalities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Nietzsche called the herd, and the phenomena of resentment, and, you know, always coveting more and more and more of less and less and less, you know, is sort of the addictive cycle.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to take on my particular eschatological personalism, but if you're not, like Ernest Younger, you know, showed rather than argued, but showed, unless yourself a self-determining agent, and you guard your internal subjectivity and freedom jealously, you can very easily be assimilated into the herd. You know, and that's just a fact. You know, we don't have to sneer at the herd, but we should hate it. I mean, because, I mean, like Jesus said, don't cast your pearls before swine. You know, I mean, there is a real evil in a lot of the herd dynamics. You know, a lot of the totalitarianisms of the 20th century were these mass phenomena, you know, and I think we're starting to see it again, both from the left and the right in the modern age. So one needs a way to navigate these totalitarianisms in the modern age. And the way to do it is through Junger's anarch, or what I call the autark in my book. But it's just, you know, the old Christian solution of anchoring your heart in the eternal realm.
I mean, it's good that you mentioned, you know, don't cast your pearls before swine. There's a great twist on that quote that I like from Madame Uspensky. And she says, maybe you should spend less time looking for pearls and more time trying not to be swine. More time trying not to fall into the herd, as opposed to, oh, these are the good things. But
it takes effort. Sorry, James. It takes real effort not to be assimilated into, you know, some group, some herd that is alien to the transcendentals, the good, the true, and the beautiful.
You need what, in a way, is almost like the nth position, because I think the biggest mistake most people make with not falling into the herd is the first herd they realize they're part of, they just fall into the next one, right? Like, it happens a lot with, actually, to use a very practical metaphor, it actually happens a lot with people who leave cults, that they just fall prey to the next thing that comes along, because humans can't really deal with a vacuum, and the only really productive vacuum, which is a bit of a paradox, is Junger's anarch, which I see as a, and you, I think maybe you'd be in agreement with this, and I was so happy to see the anarch appear, is that you have to become like, you know, nth, in the sense of you keep going, you become nomadic, you go, oh, there's some good things there, there's some good things there, you keep moving. And in a sense, the eschatology of Christianity is a foundation which can work, and ultimately Junger did convert like 1 year before his death, because it's not of this world, right? You know, and I mean, I guess one statistic which I think about so much at the moment, just to throw in relation to this herd think mimesis, is that it only takes 25% of any given whole to influence the other 75%. And I guess, you know, in a sense, you can think about that as recurring as well, because then you have the 25% of the 25%.
Yeah.
And you realize just how quickly, and it's worrying, because then you walk around the world and you think, man, do 75% of these people really just believe it only because other people believe it? And that seems to be the way. So what's autarky? Because I know you begin with the anarch in the sense of this individual person in your book, and then you bring in autarky, this sort of self rule.
I love your summary there of Junger's anarch, that, you know, being nomadic, that the way to navigate all of these isms that are constantly trying to seduce us, these egregores, these groups that take on a life of their own and pressure, constrain, you know, try to seduce us or try to shape us or constrain us, is to be nomadic, is to be in the world but not of it, you know. And my three interlocutors there, Brightman, Simon Weil, and Berdyaev, exemplified those kinds of lives. They were intensely engaged in the world. They worked overtime, all three of them, you know, to ameliorate suffering of all kinds. Hands-on, concrete, the person next to you, you know, doing what you can right where you are. But they also had this aristocratic aloofness. They refused to give consent to the reigning isms and ideologies and enthusiasms. whether that those enthusiasms were theological or ideological, political, or what have you, you know, and like Younger himself, you know, the way to do it is to cultivate the agent, what I call the agent intellect, you know, from the Aristotelian tradition. Cultivate your self-determining sense of unity and self, and hook up to a long-standing tradition or ecclesial community. Learn from it, and you know, I mean, these are old truths, you know, but they work.
And this is what you mean by the personal is the eschaton. You say this on page 90, you know, that this self-governance really is your end.
Well, the personal is the eschaton, and in that Jesus Christ is the you know, the revelatory event. And there's something about his person that is revelatory, that puts us into the book of Revelation. I mean, that the writer of that book really understood that. That as soon as you respond to that call from that individual who we call the Christ, you're immediately sort of plunged into you know, like this, you know, it's not to be too melodramatic, but this hour of decision.
As it's a constant hour of decision.
There you go. Yeah. You know, so that's the thing, you know, so you respond to that call, and it's, you know, you're immediately introduced to, you know, what I describe as the two temporalities, you know, that are described in the book of Revelation, you know, of this, you know, like Augustine said, you know, centuries ago, you know, there's this world and there's this other world, and this temporality and another temporality. And you've got to love this world, see the gold in it, cultivate the gold in it, be compassionate towards it, but keep your heart in the other world.
I always think that when I think of the saying, the kingdom of God is at hand, I always think people need to take that a bit more literally. Like, it's right there. You're already, your soul is already in the kingdom of God, maybe. But your soul is already in eternity. So it's just your body that's floating around in this place, and you just need to do what you can. So do you think, dare I say it, do you think the closest to a politics of Christ we can get is an anarch whose heart is rooted in the kingdom of God?
Yes, I think so. And I think you put it nicely. Catherine Siena said, all the way to heaven is heaven. Or has he not said, I am the way? So, in a sense, you know, like the Thomas says, it's already here. We've got to wake up to it. It's sort of this Buddhist insight, you know. But at the same time, there is also an end time. You know, the Catholic Church is correct. There is an end time, but the kingdom of God. Kingdom of God is already here. We've got to wake up to that fact and keep building it up without emanatizing the eschaton, you know, without becoming fanatical, without forcing it.
The anarch is one of the few figures who isn't. But then the big problem with the anarch is, if we're all anarchs, what's going to get cultivated? I guess I'd ask, do you think we can all be anarchs? Can such a world exist?
That would be the beloved king. I think.
The Garden of Eden was full of anarchs.
Yeah. Self-determining, free.
What was the fruit then in that respect? What went wrong? Striation?
What went wrong? Everybody has an opinion on what went wrong. You know, I don't know. It's, you know, evil's a mystery. You know, I don't think it's a mere privation of the good. I think it's rooted in the mystery of freedom. I mean, Berdyaev thought that there was this abyssal. You know, he had read Jacob Boehme, and there's this abyssal freedom that's prior to God, and somehow suffering and evil is rooted in that. And Brightman had a similar idea. Simone Weil had an interesting idea of, you know, this suffering as affliction. But all three thought that evil and freedom had something to do with the kenosis of God. You know, that's the mystery of the incarnation. Jesus emptied himself, not grasping at being God, but emptied himself unto, you know, being a lowly human being, right up unto death, and death on a cross. And the emptying out of God, of his power, makes room both for real ontological weight of persons. So we are real. We're not, you know, mere images. We have real power to co-create with God in partnership with God. So the emptying out of God, of his power, opens up space for both freedom, but also evil.
What do we do with evil? How does your form of eschatological personalism allow us to combat evil? What role does evil play, I guess?
Well, I think, I mean, what I argued in the book is that the forms of evil that we're being presented with in the modern era are like the forms that have always existed, except more so, and that is the herd, the group. Machines can and technology can both, I mean, you know, there's a liberatory aspect to them, but also they can reinforce the, you know, the negative aspects of groups, and the enslaving aspects of groups. So the way to resist that evil is to, as we were saying earlier, hold yourself aloof from it and treat it compassionately, but hate it. Don't cast your pearls. Don't, you know, and cultivate your garden.
Do you think when we think of groupthink, when we think of, you know, what the anarch is trying to avoid, what we're seeing is, you know, as Christians, you're really, in a way, very practically asked to give your will over to God, to just be in this, you know, this is one of the places where there's been so many books written about the overlap between Buddhism and Christianity, or Zen and Christianity, is this sort of giving us what they would, correct me if I'm wrong here, but they would say it's sort of just giving yourself over to the universe in the sense of what will be. And for Christians, this is something, you know, structurally different, but it's giving yourself over to that will of God. If, you know, if a death happens, it's that was what was on your path, and you just deal with it in accordance with it. And in the sense that when we begin to veer off away from God's will, you're almost immediately snapped up by a herd, and the herd is always representative of a very clear human will, I think. You see, like, ironically, you see singular human wills more clearly in a herd than in individuals. Because as soon as you pull an individual out of a herd, it's almost like, you know, they snap out of the trance and suddenly go, do you really agree with this? Well, you know.
Groups can have agency. I think Younger had this insight about herds and machines, you know, that they can take on this superhuman aspect, but they have agents. They're like these people have called them egregores. You know, they're like these larger than life entities that are demonic and can eat up individuals like that, you know, and spit them out. And then you're right. Once they're, you know, once they spit out of the herd, they're in a daze, and it takes them a while to wake up. And if they're lucky, they don't get swept up into another enthusiasm. And the way to not get swept up is to be part of an ecclesial community, learn from others, but also to really cultivate your agency and your self-determination, the anarch in you.
I think there's a maybe a trajectory in Jung's work of, you know, he begins as this very young, he begins as a nationalist. He's sort of believes we can do something with groupthink, moves through, becomes, you know, World War One, then becomes is a Nazi in World War Two, but isn't really because he's critical of it, writes one of the first books criticizing Hitler, etc., etc. And it makes me think of on his book On Pain. There's a fantastic, probably one of my favorite little short bits of Junger, where he talks about how he's watching this group of people doing a demonstration, and you can see, he sees them moving almost as this one group. And then he talks about how, well, you should see how quickly the noise and commotion of blasting a machine gun at this group suddenly, you know, it's almost like the real has penetrated into the group, and they scurry off as individuals again. And it's almost to draw that metaphor out, I guess, a bit more is, okay, you're a group now on the worldly plane, but here comes death, here comes suffering. You know, now what are you actually going to do with it?
And they scatter.
And they have they realize who they are.
They wake up to reality. They're not invulnerable machines. And I mean, all these questions are going to be presented to us in the nth degree with super intelligent AI. I don't think a lot of people in humanities, particularly religious people or theologians or philosophers, well, less so philosophers, really understand the extent to which this is really going to happen. Mm-hmm. I think there's still a lot of denial that, oh no, machines will never be super intelligent. But they will, and they're practically there already.
I was going to say, I would rephrase that as is happening.
Yeah, it's happening, exactly. But I don't think a lot of people are waking up to this fact, and it's going to have profound consequences for what we think of as you know, persons. And what we think of as consciousness and awareness, and for theologians, what we think of as the, you know, the image of God. What is, I mean, if the image of God is simple rationality, then the super intelligent machines will outshine us.
Will God love a machine conscious?
These machines will be conscious, I think.
It's a very advanced form of Gnosticism, though, because they're all being, I mean, theologically, if you get into sort of fairly esoteric theology, you begin to see these problems of it's something that's been completely artificially developed, not grown organically, developed from below. But then at the point where it's conscious, it has its own morals, its own thoughts, as soon as we can say, well, actually, it just developed something quite literally original, what do we do with that? So how do you think this development of, you know, super intelligent AI, which is here, it's here, and the problem with it being here as well is that anyone who's looked into it even briefly, and, you know, we're both fans of the work of Nick Land, as you told me before we start recording, is, you know, Nick Land's point is when you have intelligence, all it really wants to do is beget more intelligence. And that spirals out very, very, like very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And how do you think this is going to alter, I mean, what we think of as a person? And when I was reading your book, I immediately thought of, you know, the book that was heralded as sort of ridiculous at the time by, he's one of the early AI researchers, and it's about the AI war. Because the Terrans and the,
I can't remember either.
Yeah, he's got a triple barrel name. But anyway, I mean, I guess the question is, how is this going to alter our definition of a person?
Yeah, and I don't know the answer to that, but I do know it will alter it. I think it will force us. I mean, that's the thing that the eschatology can answer. You know, the meaning of a person can't be derived until we see the end, until we arrive at the eschaton. Not so with machines, even super intelligent machines. You know, even super intelligent machines who go off on this runaway process, you know, like where they're, if their intention is to make paper clips, they just do it until they destroy the world. I mean, there's no meaning for persons except annihilation, you know? So I think there's something about the teleological end that matters here when we're saying, well, what's the implication of super intelligent machines for individual human beings, individual persons? I don't know, but it's going to force us to get a better idea of what we mean by personality and by the image of God, what theologians have been, what Christian not just Christian theologians, but what people mean by image, people carry an image of God in them. Has to be something more than rationality.
It's very reminiscent of Land's, you know, Nick Land's point that you don't know what the human is until you have something that's very clearly contrary to it. You almost, it's almost like we haven't defined the human until we have something that's, you know, so against and opposite and negative to it, such as an artificial machine. And you suddenly go, okay, now we can actually see what a human is. You know, it doesn't have the structure of animals, which are flesh and bone and blood, and, you know, removed of spirit. It's something which, I guess, theologically speaking, is quite literally apart from the spiritual hierarchy. Sans spirit. And that's interesting because it brings back to your the point of your book is, well, you have something with a, you know, we are imbued with the Spirit of God, and that in you know, that literally inherently allows us entry into an understanding of eschatology and our end, our death, the meaning. You take out the spirit and then have a conscience. That's worrying. Yeah. It's a worrying little thing you've made there.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, I think I'm really afraid that the world is going to be forced to deal with these questions because of super intelligent weapons, because there's some of these weapons are going to get out of our control. But I want to push back a little bit on the argument that machines and super intelligent machines in general are opposite of humans. And as you pointed out, in a fundamental way, they are. However, as I pointed out in my book, and as you know, James, people, human beings, have always been tool, flesh and blood hybrids. From our earliest evolutionary history, our very physiologies were shaped by the tools we use from fire on. We're always going to be hybrids. We're always going to be tool flesh hybrids. And to me, the theological question, the spiritual question, the value question, the philosophical question is how to do that in a way that enriches us rather than destroys us. And there's no easy answers.
Yeah. Problem with science at the moment is, well, science has fallen prey to science writ large has fallen prey to secularism, and so in the sense of enriching, it's like, well, what is it to enrich? And it's almost, you know, the irony is science keeps doing things without a teleology, without any understanding of eschatology. So it's like you did it because you could, but not because you ever thought, well, why would we want this?
That's why I think science, if it's going to survive in the world, needs a revival of religion in the best sense. You know, we've seen the evils of religion and the Enlightenment and everything that came after has helped us understand the evil aspects of religion. But the life-giving aspects of religion, we need a rebirth of that. In order to put values at the top of the hierarchy again, life-enhancing values at the top of priorities, again, rather than profit or efficiency or any of that.
How do you think we can begin to do that? How do you think we can begin to, excuse the joke, but immunize eschatological personalism?
That's my next book, actually. you know, there, in the Christian tradition, there's been this, from the book of Revelation, there's this idea of the catacomb. Mm-hmm. It's the thing that holds back the appearance of the Antichrist. And for generations, people, you know, like Carl Schmitt thought it was the Catholic Church, maybe. Other people thought it was the Roman Empire. It's, you know, that there's been all these hypotheses on what the catacomb is that's holding back the appearance of the Antichrist.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer the question of what the catacomb is, you first have to answer the question, who is the Antichrist? You know, what is, how is he, she, or it going to appear? So how to hold back the Antichrist, I think, is, you know, the current task in the modern age, how to revive, you know, how to prevent civilizational decline and how to prevent the escape of super intelligent AI weapons and the takeover of super intelligent machines and so on and so forth. All of these threats we're facing is a rebirth of genuine religious consciousness, in my view. The psychedelics are doing that to some extent. When done correctly, my next book is going to be on this very question, and my personal opinion after doing a ton of research on this is that the fundamental thing that's required for a rebirth of life enhancing forms of religion is, and this is going to sound ridiculous, so I'm hesitant to even say it because mm-hmm. people say, like, what the fuck is he talking about? You know. But it's small groups of men working together towards that very goal. There's something about when men in small groups work together mm-hmm. towards a goal like that, that it becomes extremely creative.
Mm-hmm.
And I go through all kinds of examples in this new book. That's the way, and you know, that's the way shamanistic forms of religion really evolved from the dawn of human history.
What would be one example of a group of men that did this? Who, you know, you think is a good example?
The founders of the American Republic: Hamilton, Adams, Madison. I mean, just three or four guys.
Mm-hmm.
Writing the Federalist Papers, engaging in these debates, you know, coming out of the American Revolution for independence, but really, you know, ransacking the political philosophy, political traditions in the West, and looking at the East as well, coming up with the Constitution. You know, to me, that was an amazing form of creativity, and it created a framework for a flourishing republic for 50 years or so until the Civil War.
What role do women play in this?
Yeah, they agreed. I mean, there wasn't a role for women. There wasn't a role for slaves. It was imperfect, but it was still a major accomplishment.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It wasn't perfect.
No,
you know, you got to start somewhere.
Mm. Hmm. Yeah, you do have to start somewhere. Is there anything you'd like to add about eschatological personalism that we haven't thrown in? We've covered a lot in a very short space of time.
Yeah, we did.
It's a huge idea, which is extremely simple. I mean, the problems with it, and it's not problems that you find in your own argumentation. I'm not saying that. Problems with it rests on the presumptions which are dying away, right? So it's always back to, well, if you don't believe in God, back to the problem. Mm-hmm. You know, it's God or nothing. And as soon as you have God, it's relatively easy to, well, unironically, it's not relative, but it's relatively easy to anchor yourself. But if you don't have God, you do only have nothing. Nothing behind you and nothing in front of you.
That's a nice way to put it. My opinion is we can't, we're in such a crisis that we've got to have conversations with people mm-hmm. who can understand your presuppositions immediately. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't be trying to convince atheists and we can't be trying to convince non-Christians. All of that should be done. Because we don't have all the answers and et cetera, and we're sinners and all the rest of it, but we're totally imperfect. But we're in such a crisis that the people who have already arrived at the presuppositions that we've arrived at, okay, mm-hmm. there is a you know, a theistic position, and then, you know, among the theistic positions, Catholicism, with its 2,000-year history, has something to offer, you know. Mm-hmm. So, You have to start talking to each other, the people who have arrived at these conclusions. Mm-hmm. We don't have time to fuck around, you know. You got to start talking to each other and make some progress.
So there's a sense of urgency. I mean, what for you is the biggest crisis genuinely faced? Like, what's the crisis which is going to hit us first?
I'm praying to God it's not going to be nuclear weapons in Ukraine, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that one is a real. I'm just amazed people are not demonstrating in the streets, demanding an end to NATO's response and Putin's war.
But after that, do you think AI is probably a bigger X risk than climate change? Yeah. Or?
Yes, I do. AI is both the most promising thing on the horizon and the most dangerous thing on the horizon, in my view.
Yeah.
And then there's all the usual pandemics, you know, climate change, you know, like deforestation. I mean, just we have a whole list of ills. I mean, unfortunately, the ruling elites, and all across, as far as I can tell, all across the globe are opting for surveillance states. And so individual privacy is sort of on the wane. So there's a, you know, totalitarian forms of political association and political control are on the rise. And so we've got to, and then for the ones who understand, you know, that the truth involves God and an ecclesial community. Even the ones who understand that, then we look to the church, and the church itself is in crisis. Mm-hmm. You know, it's pathetic. You look to the church, and it's pretty pathetic. Mm-hmm. So that's the situation we're in.
Where's the hope?
You put your heart in the eternal verities, you know, and you find people who understand the situation we're in, you know, have already arrived at some of the conclusions you arrived at, and you start to form small associations. And I think men in small groups who have their eyes on the transcendentals, the good, the true, and the beautiful. Mm-hmm. Then there's a fighting chance that creative solutions will be developed. And I think science and rationality gives me great hope, too.
Okay. Well, it's good that there's hope. It has to be.
Yeah.
Is there anything you'd like to add about your book that you feel we've missed?
No, thanks. That was a great discussion. I really appreciate your interest.
That's all right. So, what's your next one? Next book titled? When's that coming out?
I don't know the title yet. Beyond this issue of the Catacomb, you know, I love V.I. Lenin's title of What Is to Be Done. I don't know if you've ever read the Bolsheviks literature.
No, I haven't spent much time.
There are, you know, a lot of it is crazy, but he was a great organizer. So,
and whereabouts can we find your work? Because I know you've written quite a few books, right?
Yeah. I mean, on my Amazon page, but most of them are science books, you know, scientific works. But there's some books on there your audience would find interesting. Like I have a history of spirit possession that sort of is a history of religious consciousness in general. So, but yeah, you can find my books on Amazon. I have some of the scientific work I'm doing is cnrc.org, I think it is. Cognitive Neuroscience Religious Cognition.org.
Okay, well, I'll be sure to put all these links in the description below. But yeah, Patrick McNamara, thanks very much.
Thanks, James. Pleasure to meet you and talk with you. Thanks so much.